The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
I am honored to be the representative for the 195th Legislative District, which includes this historic building, Parkway Central, the Free Library of Philadelphia. I am both honored and thrilled to welcome you to the library tonight for our author event discussion. As a state legislator, and most importantly, as a Philadelphian and library user, I am thankful to the Free Library of Philadelphia Foundation, its members and donors for their generous contributions to programs, including the author event series, as well as the many after-school, adult learning, and other community-based services at our local neighborhood libraries that create space and access to diverse literary events across our city. It is my pleasure to introduce our phenomenal guest for the stage, the 2018 Democratic nominee for governor of Georgia, Ms. Stacey Abrams. Stacey embodies the spirit of Maya Angelou's phenomenal woman. She served in the Georgia House of Representatives from 2007 till 2017, before she became the first African-American woman to secure a major party's gubernatorial nomination in the United States. In addition, Stacey founded the Fair Fight Action, an organization to address voter suppression. Stacey doesn't just bring a chair to the table, she builds tables so more can join the conversation. So we're all here tonight because Stacey is not just a political leader. She's also a best-selling author, an entrepreneur, and a continuous fighter for historically ignored communities. Indeed, she is a phenomenal woman. Joining Stacey on stage tonight is award-winning journalist and broadcaster and beloved author events interviewer, Tracy Matysak. We are so pleased to have them with us this evening. Please join me in welcoming Tracy Matysak and Stacey Abrams to the Free Library of Philadelphia.
Oh my, thank you all for being with us tonight. We are so honored and thrilled to have Stacey Abrams with us to talk about her new book and maybe about some current events as well while we have her here. So, as always, we'll have a conversation for a little while, and we've budgeted a few minutes toward the end for your questions for Stacey. So if you do have a question, we would ask you would just raise your hand, and we've got some staff members with microphones who will get a microphone to you for your question. So with that said, what do you say we jump in and start talking about this book? So, of course, the book, as you know, is called Rogue Justice. It is the second in the series, and just released in paperback, of course. And Stacey, as I was reading the book, it felt so much to me like art imitating life. So you've got this Republican president named Brandon, no less. who is facing impeachment and possible permanent removal from office. You've got a congressman who's a rabble-rouser type, who's got a big social media following and has very little patience with rhinos. You've got judges who are compromised. And as I read the book, I thought, you know, we've seen all of these types of characters in recent years, but the amazing thing is that some of these characters were created back in 2010, before current events began to happen, and it felt, Stacey, like almost like you had a crystal ball as you wrote this book.
So I'm not psychic, but I have been in politics. So, in fact, when I wrote While Justice Sleeps, Brandon was the name I picked long ago. So it was a coincidence. It's actually named after a dear friend of mine. I mean, I like him, but clearly I didn't mind making him a nefarious president. But he got to be president, so there's that. But at the time, it was really, for me, an investigation of the issue that we hadn't started talking about, which was that Article 3 of the Constitution said that you could not, it basically makes a judge permanent, gives a judge a permanent job for life, and the only way the person could be removed was high crimes, misdemeanors, or death. And so back 2008, 2009, 2010, when I started thinking about the book, it was, well, you can remove a president using the 25th Amendment, you can just not reelect someone to Congress, but you can't get rid of a federal judge. So I wrote the book, and I thought, what would happen if we had a judge who's simply incapable of doing their job? And what if that person was the swing vote on the Supreme Court? Because, you know, that could happen. Well, when I wrote it in 20, when I tried to sell it in 2010, I was rejected by all the publishers because they said that we would never have a president who would commit, who would be involved in political intrigue abroad, that no one cared about the Supreme Court, and it wasn't really that relevant. So I put the book away and, you know, ignored it for the next 10 years. And then around 2019, 2020, somebody started thinking, maybe that could, it, you know, there might be some daily relevance. And so the initial characters came about a decade ago, but Rogue Justice was written in 2021, 22. And then I was thinking about what are the next set of issues that we should be concerned about. I am not prescient, I promise. But I read a lot of news, and I try to think of all the ways we could die. So... And so with this one, I was, the thoughts that kept pinging for me, it was what happened in Texas when the Texas grid failed. So what happened with our energy? I was reading a lot about the dark web and thinking about what does it mean to have deep fakes? Bless you. I was also spending some time thinking, my younger sister is a federal judge, and she went to a judicial conference, and when she came back, I was leafing through her brochure and nearly fell asleep. I'm like, this is what you guys, okay. But one of the conversations was about the FISA court and what did that mean? And, you know, this is, again, a few years ago. Well, on April 19th of this year, there is the reauthorization debate about the FISA court. Mm-hmm. Raise your hand if you knew much about FISA before you read Rogue Justice. You're lying. I'm joking. You're not. But there weren't very many hands that went up. Because the FISA court, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, FISA, created a court that is a secret court. So if you have a secret court in a democracy, if only certain people can know what happens, how do you then hold them accountable? And because these judges have a permanent job, they can only be removed for high crimes, misdemeanors, and death, because despite writing While Justice Sleeps, nobody changed the law. What happens if someone can compromise a judge who has that kind of power? And then I spent about 400 pages talking about it.
Well, you mentioned, cybercrime, that's a big theme of the book, the dark side of AI, deep fakes, and so forth, as you talked about it. And so you said that, you know, your sister's conference kind of got you thinking about it, but I was also wondering about what your thoughts are about the ways that AI might be used in relation to our elections.
We should be afraid. I mean, we know that in the election, I think it was in El Salvador, there was the very prominent use of AI to promote the person who eventually won election. We know that in our own elections, we have had misinformation, we have had disinformation, which are different. And we know that communities that have the least salience with technology are the most likely targets. And in a very close election, when you're talking about a few thousand votes, not that you in Pennsylvania know anything about close elections, but when elections are decided by 10,000, 20,000, 30,000 people, you don't have to convince the world, you have to convince a community. And AI makes it so much easier to do so, because what you do is you prey upon the weaknesses, the fears, and the vulnerabilities. But you also promise things that one either doesn't want to verify, or they're so taken by the possibility, they're willing to suspend their disbelief. And as we head into this election cycle, I'm deeply afraid that there are communities that will be aggressive targets of AI, of deepfakes, but also of misinformation that gives them just enough that it's slightly wrong, but not enough that it seems absurd, or disinformation, which is just an outright lie, where they will manufacture information to convince you that what you know isn't true. And what is so compelling to me is that if we don't talk about it, we won't build the muscle memory to know what to look for. And so I try to take my writing to a place where it's not just about what's wrong, but what do we do about what we see? How do we engage, and how do we prepare for it? And so I think we know now that AI is going to play a meaningful role. I know that AI and deepfakes are only one facet of what we're facing. But I also know that we are really good people who have the capacity to share information and to help each other out. And one of the most important things is, don't share stupid, okay? Say it with me, don't share stupid. If you see it, don't say it again. You don't debunk a lie by repeating the lie, because what people remember is the lie. They don't remember why you said it. They just remember, well, I remember when Tracy said it. Even if Tracy said, don't do X because X is wrong, well, Tracy said X, and so I'm doing X. So I'm not, anyway. nor is she. I'm gonna stop digging. My point being that we have the opportunity and the obligation in this election cycle to be intentional with our information, to rebut things that we see that are wrong, but do not rebut it by repeating it. Rebut it by giving people better information that they can use, and by giving them, I mean, we're sitting in the library, giving them references so that they can go and do their own investigation, but from credible sources, and as opposed to whatever they can find.
Yeah. I want to talk more about the whole election thing in just a moment, but I do want to ask you about Avery Keen. She is our heroine in the book, and she is this brilliant Supreme Court clerk who finds herself in all manner of harrowing situations, and I wonder, was there someone who was your inspiration for that character?
Not exactly. I wrote, again, I started writing this about, I'd left the law firm, or I was a young lawyer, I left that law firm in 2003. I had a conversation that led to the construct of While Justice Sleeps around 2008 or 2009. For me, it was, I had these characters in mind. I knew I needed there to be a Supreme Court justice who, when I wrote his first scene, he was just such a curmudgeon. I love Justice Wynn, but he was a jerk. And I needed a foil for who he was. But I also needed a character who was brilliant, but who didn't completely own her power. And I wanted a character who had responsibility, but no authority. And if you're going to give someone that tension, you have to give them tools that can allow them to still accomplish their ends, but you also have to give them vulnerabilities that make the journey of watching them possible. So Avery is a composite of people I've met. She's some there are parts of her that are what I wish I was. I use some stories that I've heard, but I wanted to also give her a surrounding story in her family, both her actual family and her found family, that reflected some of the challenges and tensions that I've seen and experienced myself, but also that created space that anyone reading her could look at her and think, oh, I could be Avery.
Yeah. What drew you to fiction in particular, and do you think that it has certain advantages in terms of conveying truths?
So I grew up, my mom was a librarian when I was growing up.
Yes.
Oops. We had no money. So even my mom was a college librarian. We went to pre-K and daycare on the campus, but that shut down before my mom got off work. And my dad worked at a shipyard that was, 35, 40 miles away. So he wasn't going to get home till late. So when we got out of daycare, we slept in the stacks. So I literally slept surrounded by books. And for me, writing is just a natural part. And because of that, because I was encouraged to read anything I wanted, I didn't grow up with this sort of sharp delineation between fiction and nonfiction. I grew up thinking you need to be able to compel and convey information in a way that is accessible. And so I've been privileged to write fiction and nonfiction, to write children's books and romance and legal thrillers. I think the question is not which genre, which medium do you use? It's how do you want people to take the information in? Mm. Sometimes it has to be true. It has to be nonfiction because people need to believe that they too could do it. Mm. And then sometimes it has to be fiction because you need people to stretch their imagination of what they're capable of or what the world is capable of to feel that they can fit into that space. And so for me, it's really a question of, is this a story better told by making up the characters or by revealing character?
Hmm. So let's talk elections a little bit, shall we? We are 7 months away from the presidential election. You know better than anyone the efforts that have been made in states across the country to make it more difficult for people to vote, taking people off the voting rolls. I mean, that has been so much of your work. On top of that, there is a fair amount of apathy among younger voters who are not happy about a Trump and Biden rematch. What concerns you the most as we head into election season, and what do you think we need to do to make sure that we maximize voter turnout?
Number one, voter suppression is alive, well, and real, but we need to know how to spot it. Voter suppression exists if someone is trying, so the three measures are, can you register and stay on the rolls? Second, can you cast a ballot? And third, does that ballot get counted? So here in Pennsylvania, you all are going through a bit of a judicial conundrum of whether or not a ballot gets counted, whether the date on the ballot is the right date. That is a voter suppression conversation, because what they're trying to do is find a way to discount and discredit and discard your vote. The voter purges. We know that mass challenges, the ability for strangers to get your information and then challenge your constitutional right to vote, is one of the tactics and tools that are being used. But what we have to hold on to and be aware of is that they're trying all of the above. They're not picking one and they're like, well, we're going to do this one in Pennsylvania and we're going to do this one in Georgia. No, they're doing all of it everywhere all at once. Because often when we are overwhelmed by the sheer volume of attack, we curl into the fetal position and we just disconnect. We can't afford to do that because that's how it works. They are targeting the people. Again, you don't have to take out everyone. You just have to get communities. You have to get slices and segments. And we have to push back. We have to speak vocally and loudly about what we need. So it is insufficient for this to simply be a court conversation. If you believe that absentee ballots should exist, that you shouldn't have to show up on a Tuesday in the winter to be heard in a democracy, then people should hear your voice saying this is so important and we support the voting rights expansions that have happened in the state of Pennsylvania and we will fight to keep that. So that's number one. Mm-hmm. Number two, I'm gonna recharacterize what you asked, because I think that there is a dynamic that exists. We often ascribe apathy to young people when they say they won't vote. They say, well, I don't care. When have you ever believed a young person when they said, I don't care? That is code for, I have such complicated thoughts. I am so conflicted or confused. I can't articulate, or I don't want to articulate what is holding me back. Mm-hmm. The decision of young people of certain communities of color, of certain demographics to not vote has nothing to do with apathy. They absolutely care. They don't know what to do with their concern, with their despair, with their anguish, with their disappointment. It's because we treat elections like blood sport. And we treat it like sport, that it happens every 2 years, every 4 years, and whoever wins, wins, and whoever loses goes on about their lives. But we have to live in between elections. And so part of our responsibility is to remind folks that elections they're not a sporting event. They're also not magic. There might be a few magical politicians here, but by and large, it's not magic. Elections are medicine. We have societal ills we are trying to address, the ills that young people see in acute measure because they have lived some of the most densely informative lives imaginable. We had the luxury of ignorance. They don't. They know too much too soon, and they're trying to process it all through a filter of so much transparency, they don't know what they're looking at anymore. Mm-hmm. And if you understand that that's the concern, then your approach to young people voting is not, you should vote because X. It is, why don't you want to vote? What are you concerned about? What issues matter to you? And let me connect the dots to the ill that you see and the person who might be able to find the right medicine for you. Mm-hmm. It's also the reality that you take medicine not once, it's not like you take a shot and you're done. You gotta take medicine over and over again. And sometimes it's bitter, sometimes it feels worse than the disease. But if we don't take the medicine, if we do not do the work, whatever is wrong is going to get worse, it metastasizes. And if we shape the conversation around, here's the ill that you can help solve, but we've gotta keep trying to solve it, we've gotta keep going after it, because deciding not to address it just means it gets worse. And more importantly, it goes and finds friends. That's how we start to shift the dynamic, but we have to begin by asking, not do you care or not, but what is it that worries you? What concerns you? Articulate it for me. And then this is gonna be really hard. We have to listen to the answer. We can't interrupt to explain why they're wrong. You can't tell them why, well, that's not actually true. You have to hear. And if they don't believe you can listen, why would they believe a politician they've never met can listen either?
I want to ask you about Georgia and
nope.
Georgia's. You've been, right?
I've visited a time or two.
So there was a poll, a recent Bloomberg poll, that showed that President Biden has been narrowing the gap to some degree between himself and Trump among swing state voters, but that Trump still leads in most of those, including Georgia. There are also concerns in Georgia that among Democratic, and I'm not telling you anything you don't know, grassroots organizers who feel that there has not been enough money or attention coming into the state in the run-up to the election. You know, Fair Fight, which you founded, has had its share of legal battles that it has had to fight, and that has taken a lot of resources from them. So I guess the question is, how concerned are you about the state of Georgia, about the role that it will be able to play in the election, and what you think President Biden's prospects will be there?
So Georgia is a purple state, and what that means is they have to fight there now. When we were red, you could just, you know, come and get some cash and go on about your business. Being purple does not mean we win automatically or we lose automatically. It means we have to have protracted engagement and we have to actually compete to win. We are in a moment where there are two very sharply differentiated characters. There is no melding of the minds. There's no confusion about one side or the other. And so the issue is not the candidates, the issue is the voter. Do voters believe that voting will actually change things? Do they believe that their engagement will yield a result that they want? Because it is an act of hope to vote. And for a lot of communities, hope is hope is hard. If you understand that, then the work that has to be done is to not just revitalize hope, but again, to show that there's been progress. Because the other problem with elections and with how we sort of treat it as spectacle is that we forget how long it takes to actually do stuff. Because just because our guy won doesn't mean that their girl didn't also win. So, you know, we don't get to go there and like, now we're in charge of everything. We still have to work, we still have to navigate. And so in Georgia, what has happened is two things. One, because of the dramatic transformation, although it took a decade, it felt dramatic when people saw it finally, there was the presumption that now we're done. So, oh, we got this, we sent two US senators, we got 16 electoral college votes, we're good. No, because the other guys are still there and they remember losing. And so they doubled down. They passed an egregious, horrific set of laws right after. In 2021, they passed terrible voting laws. And even though those laws have been upheld, the fact that you can't give water to someone standing in line is terrible. But that's the least of our challenges, because they also passed a law that lets you challenge a person's right to vote. It existed on the books already, but it's been given steroids, that I can look at you and that was intentional. She's a good friend of mine. She's actually she's actually a queen in one of my books. I wouldn't call her evil. She's just misunderstood. But someone can come and pull my name and say, I challenge her right to be a voter. They don't have to give the county any reason other than I don't think she's valid. I then get a letter in the mail saying, I've got to come down to the county office and prove my right to be on the rolls. And that's spreading across the country. And the governor of Georgia, who holds the record of having purged the single largest number of voters by any secretary of state in American history in a single day, is now the governor about to sign a bill making it easier to do mass challenges. Wow. Voter suppression didn't stop in Georgia. It took on new vestiges, new language, but the same intention. You don't have to win elections if you can keep people from voting. And so I am concerned about Georgia, not because I don't think Georgia can win again for my party. I'm concerned because we have taken our attention off of the fundamental problem, which is whether or not voters had the right to access their democracy. This is not about whether Democrats can win or Republicans can win. It's about whether democracy can work in a state where they are intentionally trying to limit your access to the right to vote. Yeah. Okay, but I'm going to say something because she looks like she's about to cry. So the upside, though, is if you know something, you can do something. Right. So I created Fair Fight. I am incredibly proud of the team that managed Fair Fight. I stepped away in 22 because I, applied for this job. I didn't get it again, but whatever. And the team that stepped in did their best, but the resources started drying up because people thought the work was done. I'm so proud to have my consigliere, Lauren Groy-Wargo, who helped me create Fair Fight, who ran my campaigns. She stepped back in. She is now the CEO of Fair Fight again. We're rebuilding. We are going to be ready for this election. And yes, we need people to contribute, but contributions can be financial, they can be moral, they can simply be word of mouth. And what we're doing in Georgia has to be replicated nationwide, because everyone who wants to win in narrowly contested states, everyone has got to be on the alert. We don't need to be paranoid, but we do need to be aware. And when someone calls and says, we think this is happening, you can't look and be like, oh, that's a shame. No. The answer is, how can I help? So say it with me, how can I help? And that's how we win.
Yeah. Stacey, as you know, No Labels announced yesterday that they are standing down, largely because they could not identify a person who would be the kind of candidate that they wanted to have, or someone who would be willing to run on that ticket. But there are, of course, still third-party candidates like RFK Jr., who as of today I think was polling at 11%. I'm curious what your thoughts are about the ways in which his candidacy in particular could impact this election.
So I want to contextualize that none of the above gets a lot of votes. So on ballots, none of the above gets a lot of votes. Undecided. I'm like, you're literally standing there making a decision and you still pick undecided. So yeah. we need to properly frame what these polls are telling us. At this stage in an election, polls are reflections. They are not predictions. And they are a reflection of the questions asked, the moment that we're in, and whatever other zeitgeist is happening. So we should be aware, but I'm not yet ready for panic, because here are a few things. There's one thing to say, oh, I like this guy. Until you start to, most people have no idea what he believes in. When they start to understand what he believes in, or what other third-party candidates believe in, there are still going to be some true believers, and true believers matter. There's a narrative out there that it was those third-party voters that swung. No, there was also remarkably rampant voter suppression under the governors of those states that eliminated access to the ballot for entire swaths of populations, that if you counted those folks up too, they would have overwhelmed the number of third-party voters had they been even allowed to vote. So let's not give ourselves these very narrow stories about what happens. We should be aware, and if you want your person to win, If the person that you want is Joe Biden, then you should work really hard. If it's not Joe Biden, I don't really care what you do. The free library is nonpartisan. I do not have that problem. But what I intend for us to take from this is that third party candidates have an effect most often when no one is talking about what the actual possibility is. There is not a pathway for a third party candidate to win an election in America. And so our conversation can't just be, don't vote for him because the other guy might win. It's vote, don't vote for him because this is what we need from our government. Fear only gets you so far on a ballot. We've got to get people to a positive understanding of what's possible, not just don't do it because we're angry, because we've been angry for a minute. Anger is no longer a sufficient motivation for action. We now have to move towards, here's what is actually possible if we do the work we need to do.
Yeah. One more poll question for you, and that is, there was a recent New York Times Siena poll that showed that black support for Donald Trump has increased over the last 4 years from 4% to 23%. I wonder what you think about that.
Remember how I talked about misinformation and disinformation?
Yeah.
So hold on, I'll answer in a second. Go ahead.
So I guess my question is, assuming that that's accurate, what does President Biden need to do, in your view, to attract, to in some cases perhaps win back the black voters who put him over the top the last time?
Okay. So one of the most aggressive misinformation tropes that gets trotted out with just stunning regularity is the shift of black men. Mm-hmm. Their desertion, so I speak from experience. 2022, I did something interesting. When I run for office, I talk to all the communities of interest that might care. I talk to women, I talk to doctors, I talk to chambers of commerce, I talk to black men. And I mention that I'm talking to them because I think they have specific needs that maybe should have attention. So I had a series of conversations about black men. The headline wasn't, candidate for office talks to voters to find out what they need. The story in the New York Times, black men don't like Stacey Abrams.
Wow.
I had the same polling numbers as Raphael Warnock did with black men. We got the same numbers. He got a little bit like let's get a point. It may be that, you know, he was a sitting senator, but we were nearly identical. And yet the New York Times article was entirely about me losing black men. And nothing about the guy who had the exact same numbers. Hmm. Because one of the ways that you divide voters, that you undermine elections, is by trotting out old tropes that work. You use them because they work every time. But here's the reality. Black men vote nearly identical to black women. They are slightly more conservative. That's just because it happens. But it is not a meaningful number. Hmm. And in the last 60 years, there has not been someone of the Republican persuasion who has achieved that stunning number. When they break 10%, it is a marvel. And I'm trying to remember who it was. But the reality is black men are not dramatically shifting. Now, it is true that there is a shift in the language and in the conversation, but that also goes to who's being targeted with disinformation. How are you asking the question? If you ask, do you like Donald Trump? Or if you ask, do you like Joe Biden? In this moment, the answer could shift. It's, will you wake up on Tuesday and go and vote for this person and take off time off of your job to do this? You're gonna get a different set of answers. But we have to remember that, and Michael Harriet of The Root wrote a fantastic piece about this. Black men are used as scapegoats for so many narratives. Mm. It doesn't stop. And what I believe that any candidate for office should do is tell people how you are going to serve their needs, show them that you hear their concerns, offer them ideas for what you're going to do, and to be held accountable for what you accomplish. But what should never happen is that an entire population is used as a scapegoat to defend or define what is going to happen in the future without ever asking them really what was going on or looking at a past practice that does not support or at all defend the assertion being made.
Thank you. I think that's really important. And speaking of important issues, of course, we've all been talking a great deal about the overturning of Roe versus Wade and the efforts in so many states to eliminate, in some cases completely, access to abortion. How big an issue do you think that that will be come November?
I think Florida's in play because... So a month ago, if you asked if Florida was going to be on the list of swing states, the answer was an unequivocal no. But two things happened last week. Maybe it was this week. It's been a long week. The state Supreme Court said that the 15-week ban could go into effect, and that automatically triggered a 6-week ban. Georgia has a similar 6-week ban. This means that you have to know whether you need an abortion before you know you're pregnant. Okay, and right now, Florida is the only southern state that still has access, or at least it did until this decision. So that's the first. But the Supreme Court also authorized, because Florida allows, you know, actual citizen democracy, a ballot initiative that will enshrine in Florida's constitution the right to bodily autonomy, and that is a great thing. And I believe that if we look at what happened in Kentucky, what happened in Kansas, what has happened in state after state after state, the right to an abortion is a fundamental right, and women are going to fight to keep it. I know in the state of Georgia, it wasn't sufficient in part because people didn't understand exactly. It had already become law. But in places where there is an actual mechanism to undo the harm, I believe that the women and good men of Florida are going to stand up. I think across the country, what happened in Alabama with IVF, they're not done. The hospital that was providing the IVF treatments has decided to stop anyway. We know that there are states that are currently considering banning IVF treatments. And so I think that women who are 52% of the electorate might decide that they want to have something to say about their bodies before we become Gilead. So I do think it's going to matter in the 2024 election.
So, Stacey, most of us know you not only as an author, but mainly as someone who fights for political power for those who do not have a voice. But in more recent years, you've kind of devoted yourself to a completely different type of power, namely electrification. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about Rewiring America and why you've decided to focus your energies there.
Those were amazing puns. Well done. So among my projects, one is that I work with a group called Rewiring America. And yesterday, it was actually part of a consortium of five organizations called Power Forward Communities that received one of the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund awards. Basically, what that means is that we got $2 billion to help make sure families get access, especially low-income families, have access to electrification and to residential electric appliances. The reason this matters is that 42% of energy, of carbon-related energy emissions, are from the home and decisions you make in the home. So what you drive, how you cook, how you heat and cool your home, 42%, which means that if we want to turn the tide on climate change, you have to actually take action in the home. President Biden, through the Inflation Reduction Act, allocated billions of dollars, secured billions of dollars for this purpose. And chief among the needs is to get that money into the hands of homeowners and renters and anyone who lives inside. For me, this was an incredibly important issue. So last year when I came on board, for some, it feels new that I would suddenly talk about energy. I've actually cared about environmental issues for much of my life. I grew up in Gulfport, Mississippi. My dad worked in Pascagoula, and I was a part of the Louisiana Forensic League. Basically, I debated in Louisiana because we were the only debate team south of Jackson, and that was too far to go, so New Orleans was closer. But to get there, we had to go through Cancer Alley, a set of towns that were the dumping ground of petrochemicals and horrible politics. And it cemented for me as a high school student how critical it was to have government that was responsive to the needs of people. When you make zoning laws that make your people sick, and when you refuse to give them access to health care or any remediation, that is wrong. And so I wrote my college thesis on environmental justice issues. I actually interned for the EPA, for the Environmental Criterion and Assessment Office in North Carolina, and then for the Office of Environmental Justice, my second turn. It has always been critical to me because democracy matters to me, but democracy is not an isolated construct. Democracy is how we make the world the way we want it to be. And if we want people to have clean air, clean water, to be able to enjoy the fullness of their lives, democracy demands that we take action on climate. So to me, it's not a departure. It's just an expansion of what people see me doing. And I'm excited about what's to come because these dollars, they're going to be here in Pennsylvania. They're going to be in every state in the country. These dollars need to get to the families that require them. And what this program does, $27 billion has been broken up across 8 recipients. What it does is it says, we're going to not just tell you you can have it, we're going to make sure you can get it. We're going to finance the equipment. You might not be able to walk into a Home Depot or a Lowe's and just pick up a heat pump if somebody doesn't help you subsidize it. Well, that's what these dollars are for. And Rewiring is one of the organizations that's going to make sure that families get what they need over the next few years. And I'm excited about the work.
Yeah. So... So before we get to our audience questions, one last thing. There is a rumor going around that there's going to be another gubernatorial election in Georgia in 2026, and just wondering if your name might be on the ballot.
I hadn't heard that rumor, so...
I think there's some folks who would like that very much.
I will say this. I am not done with politics, but I don't know what politics wants to do with me next. So we will figure that out.
Stay tuned.
My name is Monique Curry-Mims, and I am the owner and publisher of Generosity, which is the region's social impact outlet. You've mentioned the New York Times article. You mentioned youth. What is the role that media needs to play when it comes to the election and living in between them?
Absolutely. That's a fantastic question. We have to stop permitting false equivalence. There is a difference between balance and false equivalence. If one side is setting fire and the other side knows where matches are, it's not the same to say both are arsonists. It's one is setting fire and the other one had a book of matches. But media today, in order to not offend or in order to protect themselves against accusation, create false narratives or worse, tilt information in ways that create a pox on all your houses. There's also a very startling lack of investigation of just baseline information. So one issue that I'm working on is DEI, so diversity, equity, inclusion. DEI did not get created in a Harvard laboratory 20 years ago. DEI means, diversity means all people. Equity means fair access to opportunity. Inclusion means everyone is allowed to participate in their version of the American dream. That's DEI. DEI has been in this country for 248 years. And you know how I know that? Because once we ended the Revolutionary War and started making rules, every movement we have had since that time, the beginning with the movement to end slavery, was about diversity, equity, and inclusion. Suffrage, gender rights, labor rights, the disability movement, the Chicano movement, the AAPI, every struggle that we have had in this country to tell the story of who we are, but more importantly, to make certain that the laws of this country reflected our ability to have a pathway to the American dream, is DEI. But the press writes about DEI like it's a terrible course you have to take for 4 hours in your corporation commanded by HR. That reductive frame has allowed three men, Edward Blum, Stephen Miller, and Chris Rufo, to run amok. And because the press does not investigate, and more importantly, interrogate their intention and do the research necessary to provide a counter-narrative, people think the DEI is dead. DEI isn't dead. DEI is the pathway to the American dream, and the minute we start talking about it in that way, the minute we start holding press accountable, then the work that you do for social impact becomes even more salient. I think the media does a good job, because I have been to places where the media is not allowed to do their job, but sufficient is insufficient. We have to do better, because people are desperate for realness and for truth, and we are losing that battle, especially for young people who do not know who to listen to, and therefore can listen to too many things that tell them not enough. But the problem is, they got the misinformation from somebody who was probably older and decided that they could do their own research and get a PhD in microbiology in 34 minutes. And so it's a very long way of saying, I grew up in a time where we got our truth from basically three things, four. You got it from ABC, NBC, and so it was Peter Brokaw, Dan Rather,
Dan Rather and Tom
Dan
Brokaw.
Dan Rather, Tom Brokaw, and Peter Jennings. Yeah. And if you were a nerd like me, Jim Lehrer.
Yep.
But everyone got the same information, and then you just picked which channel was going to tell it to you. Right. Now you can curate your own reality. And if media wants to break through that noise, it has to break through that noise by telling unabashed truth, not by catering to what they think people want the truth to be.
Hi, I'm Tara.
Hello.
We are here from Chester County. We are very active Dem volunteers, and we will be canvassing over the next few months. Do you have advice for us on how to convince that community that's in the middle, has not decided yet, and the recovering Republicans like my husband, who are not MAGA Trumpers, will not vote for him, but also have issue voting for a Democrat or Biden, and feel that not voting is not a vote for Trump?
So one is that our system doesn't work like that. Our system doesn't have an undecided category or none of the above category. You're either picking the person you want or you're picking the person you don't want. That's the baseline. So if you're talking to someone who plays sports, like deciding not to take the field means you forfeit. So they are forfeiting their vote. They're not choosing something else. And I find that sports analogies work really well. So they are throwing the game. So that's number one. Number two, though, I don't believe in conversion in politics. My parents went from being, my mom's a librarian, my dad was a shipwreck worker. They became Methodist ministers. Their job was to save people's souls. That is a lot of work. And apparently you have to do it every Sunday, and they're like, repeat, you have to keep doing it over and over again. And you won't know if you got it right until they get to the pearly gates. I don't have that kind of time or patience. I don't believe in conversion, where I need you to do what I want you to do because you suddenly believe me. I believe in convincing. And I believe in convincing using convenience. And here's what that means. I don't need you to do it because of why I want to do it. I need to find your reason for doing it. So instead of saying, vote for Biden because of X, ask them what they're concerned about. Ask them what they want to see. Ask them what issues are keeping them awake at night. What are the things they want to have happen? And then connect that dot to why the vote matters. That they're voting. You don't have to like Biden to vote for Biden. You have to like what Biden can deliver. And you have to be afraid of what will happen if he is not the person in charge. Or you have to want more for your country because you want this. My favorite example of this is that for 3 years in the state legislature in Georgia, I was minority leader for 7 years. And there was a bill, there was an environmental bill. I'm talking really fast because I can see people moving towards me telling you to shut up. There was an environmental bill that would have eroded stream buffers. Basically, you could build closer and closer to the land, or you could do things that would make it easier for water to flood. And the Chamber of Commerce wanted it, the governor wanted it, the lieutenant governor wanted it, they moved it to the Senate, passed like that. Speaker was all in for it, so it was coming to the House. I'm minority leader, I don't have any of the votes I need. But I was like, I went to see my friend, and I use friend loosely, who was the head of the Tea Party. And I asked her to go to lunch with me. I was like, look, you don't believe in climate change. She's like, no, I don't. I said, but you believe in property values. She's like, yeah. I said, your property values will go down, but your taxes will not decrease if they can erode the stream buffers, because you guys own a lot of the land they're talking about. And do you think the companies pushing for this bill are going to pay your bills? She was like, no. I said, so do you want your property taxes to go up? She was like, no. I said, then you need to help me kill this bill. We killed that bill 3 years in a row so badly that they finally just took it back. I didn't have to convince her to agree with me. I had to convince her that what she wanted could be accomplished by doing what I wanted. Conversion does not work. You don't have that kind of time or holy water. Convincing does.
So I do have a really quick question. In about 2 weeks, I have an invite to go to the White House. So for those people who may be on the fence when it comes to Biden or Trump, what suggestion would you give me in asking him some really targeted questions that I could bring back to provide some answers for people back in the community?
So, well done, you did. You are going as a representative of a community, so before you go there, ask the folks around you what they want to know. No one decides not to participate in our democracy because they don't want it to be better. They don't participate because they don't think it can get better. But there's usually some story around their despair, around their concern, and sometimes it's because they're attributing malice or fault to a president who didn't have the ability to do a thing about it. But you can't know that unless they tell you what those things are. And so the first step is to do your own survey. Find out what, it's a fantastic, if you could ask the president a question, what would it be? Use your social media, find out what those questions are. Curate those questions, and then bring them to the president. Because part of, I've had the privilege of meeting President Biden. He genuinely wants to know. And I can say without hesitation, he has been one of the most prolifically successful policymakers in a generation. On issues that matter, he has done the work. The problem is politics is fast. Policy is slow. Yeah. And a lot of what he accomplishes won't be known or seen or felt for a while. And so part of it is, what are the things that he's done that you can articulate? But also, what are the things that he wants to do that if he has 4 more years, he can do? And connecting that back to the things that they're concerned about, the fears that they have, most people aren't just afraid for themselves, they're afraid for their community, they're afraid for their family. What is it that he can offer them in 4 years that will make that fear a little easier to bear?
Well, I don't know about you, but I have learned so much from this conversation. Please join me, ladies and gentlemen, in thanking Stacey Abrams for all the wisdom she shared with us.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.